Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We're glad you're here today. We have one case we're hearing this morning. It's an en banc case. And before we call the case, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my far right is Justice Mike Wallach. Seated next to him is Justice Dabney Basil. And then to my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr. To my far left is Justice Brian Walker. Seated next to him is Justice Dana Womack. And to my left is Justice Wade Birdwell. And I'm Bonnie Sutterth. I'm the Chief Justice of the Court. It's my understanding that everyone is here and everyone is ready. And before we begin, I'll ask the clerk to call the case. You may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Hannah Robler on behalf of the appellants, Ms. Michaela Montoya Frazier, and the Buckle Bunnies Fund. This court has observed that Rule 202 petitions are intended to be narrow pre-suit discovery vehicles that are subject to strict limitation and careful supervision. That's the court's language in In re Kadetz, which is a recent opinion that Chief Justice Sutterth authored in November of 2023, quoting In re Wolf, because that's the language the Texas Supreme Court also uses.
Could you speak up just a bit?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Does it help if I move the microphone up
a little bit,
too? Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. This court has also observed that Rule 202 petitions are not appropriate to do what one would ordinarily do in a traditional lawsuit. This petition in this appeal should have been dismissed for several reasons that involve the TCPA, the motion that was filed below, but this court, noting that the initial briefing in this case primarily focused on that question, application of the TCPA to the Rule 202 petition here, really needed additional supplemental briefing on a threshold question. So the court requested supplemental briefing on this first step, which, as the court will notice in its bench exhibits, Exhibit 1 has these three TCPA bubbles of the operation of that analysis, and the first bubble is split into two to recognize the court's need for that threshold question first. That threshold question was addressed by this court in 2018 in DeAngelis, which then prompted that request for supplemental briefing about whether the court should adhere to that prior precedent in determining the TCPA applies to Rule 202 petitions at all, much less this one specifically. The court should adhere to the prior precedent in DeAngelis for a few reasons. The court has seen briefing on that. The primary reason is that the only live clash that appears to still exist between the parties about what the issue about DeAngelis might be, why the TCPA might not apply generally, is a party argument, not a legal action argument. So to the extent that the party argument is unavailing for several reasons, the court should adhere to DeAngelis. The DeAngelis opinion is also well-reasoned. It's rightly decided. It uses the canons of statutory interpretation the right way. It's consistent, too, with what we've seen from the legislature after the DeAngelis decision. And the majority of Texas courts agreed with this court, followed that DeAngelis holding, often cite the DeAngelis holding to say it makes sense that TCPA would apply to Rule 202 petitions generally.
Do you find anything noteworthy about the 2019 amendments to a carve out for what a legal action actually is?
Justice Kerr, I think there are several things noteworthy about the 2019 amendments. And Your Honor asked about this about a month ago, too, in the Bolero arguments, which deal with a similar kind of discussion of TCPA and Rule 202. So in 2019, the legislature first expanded the definition of legal action, then did provide some specific carve outs, chose not to exclude Rule 202 specifically in those carve outs, exclusions of what constitutes a legal action or not. And the court will have seen in the supplemental briefing that there are good reasons to read the language in the text to interpret it such that legal actions, even in that carve out, that the carve out doesn't cover Rule 202 petitions because of surplusage. There's an additional reason. If the court looks at the legislative history of the 2019 session, there actually was a proposed bill introduced by Representative Burroughs that suggested including explicitly Rule 202 as an exception from legal action. We all know that that's not the one that made it in. Instead, we have the 2019 amendment that does not explicitly exclude Rule 202 in those carve-outs.
But isn't it true that at that time the legislative session started, there were only two opinions that had come out? One was in the middle of Christmas, before the legislative session. DeAngelis was one, then another one, and then the Houston courts came down with their decisions in the middle of the legislative session. So what are we to take from that?
That's right, Justice Birdwell. Certainly, the decisions that had come out at that point were N. Ray Elliott out of the Austin Court of Appeals in 2016, which is consistent with this court's holding in DeAngelis. And so in 2019, we didn't see the same kind of consideration or split. Notably, the legislature has met since then. We don't see any shift from the legislature. There doesn't seem to be anything in even the esteemed Jerry Bullard's papers with Representative Leach talking about those kinds of changes and what the court or what the legislature is looking at. We don't have any indication towards the carve-out. We don't have any indication that Congress is trying to include Rule 202. The only legislative history, should the court choose to get there, which obviously we don't think it needs to, indicates that the legislature, when considering it, has chosen not to. It's not a question that has escaped Congress's notice, certainly.
Appley made some concessions, it seems at least, in his supplemental brief in this area, but he brings up this, I guess you could say, somewhat novel argument about parties and whether or not, in fact, the Rule 202 petitioner was a party, the respondent is a party. And, you know, what's your thoughts on that?
Yes, Justice Walker. So there is sort of the only seeming remaining clash point, given that the parties, in a point of rare agreement, seem to agree that legal action probably does contain Rule 202 petitions. The party argument fails for a couple of different reasons. The first, and perhaps most compelling, is referenced in Exhibit 3 of the bench exhibits that the court has, which is the language from N. Ray Jordan, which is a Texas Supreme Court case. It's a slightly different context, so bear with me a little bit, but it's a Rule 202 petition assessed with the TMLA, so still dealing with things like discovery, what are you entitled to before serving, things like expert reports. And in N. Ray Jordan, the Texas Supreme Court said, where you have identified individuals, these proposed opponents, there is a party, a person, an entity on the other side, as having adverse interests to a suit, you cannot call them, quote, non-parties. To write an opinion that uses Maxwell's interpretation, a creative argument about captions and who's named in a caption, to write the opinion and hold for Maxwell on that issue would require saying, despite the fact that Maxwell's petition does identify the appellants as individuals and entities with adverse interests, that's at page 13 of the clerk's record, despite that, they are non-parties, which is a stark one-to-one against that language in Jordan when interpreting Rule 202 and who is a party to that kind of action. So I think that N. Ray Jordan gets the court to at least the point of, who do we contemplate to be a non-party when you've named them in a petition? This isn't the kind of case where you say, I really don't know who I'm supposed to sue. I'm just investigating. It could have been 13 different guys, but I have a witness over here and I really want to talk to you. This isn't that kind of case even. I think it probably doesn't even get the court that far because of some other reasons we could talk about. But certainly in this case, on this record, on page 13 of the record, where you have those named individuals, there's not a way to square that with Jordan.
You want us to parse what kind of 202 action it is as to whether the TCPA applies?
No, Your Honor. And Justice Basil, you make a good point. So there's not a distinction as far as whether it applies yes or no in investigation or anticipation of suit. What we do know is that Jordan language is particularly strong and indicative on this record of saying it cannot be a non-party, certainly where they've been identified as having adverse interests. That said, that's not the only reason that the party argument fails. The other two, one is that there isn't a court of appeals that Maxwell has cited any majority opinion that indicates that's the proper reading of the statute. That origination comes from Justice Pemberton's concurrence in the N. Ray Elliott opinion. As this court is well aware, there is no argument raised in the concurrence that escapes the notice of the majority. So it's not as though the court in N. Ray Elliott that Justice Borland missed it and they would have adopted that if possible. So it's only come up in a concurrence. Other courts have not chosen to adopt that interpretation, we think for good reason, because it does provide this sort of absurd interpretation of bringing a Rule 202 and then saying, but you're not a party to it, you can't move to dismiss, and getting this sort of get out of TCPA free card.
With all due respect, and maybe my mind's running slow this morning, but how does that defeat Appley's argument that there are going to be certain parties or certain people at least, or certain interested individuals or maybe witnesses that are not actual legal parties, but they're somebody that they're actually wanting to depose simply for the sake of just trying to get what they need on the record.
Right, and Justice Walker, I think the distinction is the difference between someone who would be a defendant to the legal action you're filing and a party to that Rule 202 proceeding. And Justice Pemberton's concurrence in Elliott actually supports that reading when talking about a party, someone from whom relief is requested. A Rule 202 petition is asking for that, even of that witness, right? They're saying, I want to take your deposition. I can't just say, no, thank you. A Rule 202 proceeding has some real power behind it, and in fact, a court behind it as well. So even if we were to take Justice Pemberton's
It reminds me of, you'll have occasionally in the marital context people who claim that they've been common law married after they've announced that they've been engaged because they want to try to get money from maybe a common law type situation. You know, you have essentially lawsuits in view of, or at least a petition in view of a lawsuit. How can you argue that there is actually a real conflict and they are real parties if the mechanism itself is something that's designed simply in view of a possibility?
Your Honor, I would first clarify that there certainly Rule 202 is contemplated in view of a possibility, but there are a couple of different ways 202 petitions can be used, and here Maxwell has chosen to use both of them. So to the extent that the record in front of the court indicates anticipated action, we think there's liability, you've opened yourself up to liability, you'd be parties with adverse interests. Page 25 of the appellee's brief actually calls Ms. Montoya Frazier the opposing party. That's relevant when there's discussion even in the trial court and here about statements against party interests. And so that's sort of the cabining in we see with something like a Rule 202, where it is looking down the line at the possibility of a claim of some kind of lawsuit at the end of it. It's this preliminary legal action, but there's a lawsuit potentially at the end of it. Whether it's the potential defendant or a person that you think may have relevant information for your claim, there's still relief requested from that individual who is a party to the Rule 202 proceeding. So even if I were to say, okay, I found another defendant, if I'm seeking relief from this person in the Rule 202 proceeding to say, you actually don't have any ability to move to dismiss this, even though I'm asking for things from you, even though I'm hoping to get a court order that says you've got to give stuff to me. There's a reason that the courts of appeals, the majorities, have not interpreted party to...
Let me ask you this, because I noticed in your original briefing, I think it was, that you made an argument about the two different 202 purposes, and the venue would be different if you're just investigating a potential claim. And as I understand it, Ms. Frazier lives in Bexar County. So can a petitioner in a 202 say it's going to be either or when some of the results of how you structure it are going to determine where the petition should be filed?
Your Honor, that's part of why certainly we in our briefing espouse and we think that the reading of the rule indicates that there needs to be a selection of one, that it does lend this sort of blurred lines if you try to advance a theory under both. That said, it's not a decided issue by this court. It's not a full stop concern, and it's also not dispositive to this case. So we do think that a petitioner who chooses to bring both prongs at the same time does introduce some confusion to the analysis. That said, the analysis on this case, because the TCPA gives the court this sort of mechanical way to walk through it, thankfully is not dispositive on this issue and doesn't need to be parsed out. And that's because if the court determines that the TCPA applies more generally, as it did in DeAngelis, and appropriately so, walking through those canons of statutory interpretation, watching what the legislature has done after, watching the majority of other courts of appeals agree with that decision, and then if the court determines that it applies specifically in this case, all that does is then trigger Maxwell's burden. It doesn't obviously result in dismissal. There's no parade of horribles of just invoking the TCPA, but it does involve that balancing of the interests where it puts the burden back on Maxwell to say, if the TCPA applies, there's a party to a legal action who has a petition filed based on or in response to the exercise of one of those TCPA-protected rights, now you have to just show that you can provide by clear and specific evidence a prima facie case for your need for a pre-suit deposition. that is an example of the Rule 202 petition and the TCPA kind of holding hands in this way of how we answer that question. That's Exhibit 2 of the bench briefs in front of the court, is breaking down exactly what Maxwell then has to prove. Under both of those prongs, that's why we brief it that way, is that Maxwell chose to bring it under both prongs, appropriately or inappropriately. On this record, Maxwell fails to meet his burden either way.
Well, let me ask you a more procedural type question. Let's say that we do decide that we don't like DeAngelis anymore. Did you request alternative mandamus relief? I mean, what would happen to this 202 if we send it back?
So, Justice Kerr, in this case, because we appealed the denial of the TCPA motion, we have the right for an interlocutory appeal that way because the legislature considers this important enough to protect. That stayed the proceedings below. So if it were to go back down, mandamus relief would be available for that particular portion, granting of the Rule 202 petition, which is obviously separate from the TCPA question as well.
But that's not something that we could determine whether Maxwell met the burden to show all the things that you need to show about the benefit burden analysis, for example.
So what the court does do in a TCPA analysis, instead of answering the abuse of discretion mandamus question about whether the Rule 202 is proper, it does inquire, and we see this in DeAngelis as well as the more recent opinion, out of this court and out of the Amarillo court, that the question is, and I see my time has expired. May I briefly finish answering the question?
Finish the answer.
Thank you, Chief Justice. The question becomes a clear and specific evidence of a prima facie case for the claim under the TCPA. This court has held that the claim in a Rule 202 is whether you have shown that you need a pre-suit deposition. So that's the exercise that this court would engage in, and that is appropriate to do on the TCPA analysis as well.
Thank you. Did you have a question?
I did have a question, but it's going to be detailed. I can try it.
You'll wait for rebuttal?
No, it wouldn't be fair to wait for rebuttal.
Okay, go ahead.
Let me ask this one question. Setting aside party, legal action, et cetera, would you not agree that TCPA actually deals with an adjudication? And what I want to focus on is the third step in the analysis, which before 2019 allowed for a trial court to enter a judgment based upon an affirmative defense, which constituted an adjudication. Okay, it now allows for the trial court to enter a judgment as a matter of law, which is an adjudication, which collateral estoppel, res judicata would apply to. There's no aspect of a Rule 202 proceeding which allows for an adjudication of a cause of action. So how are we to reconcile that, those two appearing to be irreconcilable aspects of these two proceedings?
Justice Birdwell, I think the answer very briefly would be twofold. That first, the TCPA doesn't mandate adjudication. It just applies to petitions that seek some kind of legal or equitable declaratory relief. Here, there is a seeking of equitable.
But you cannot get a dismissal with prejudice on a Rule 202, which would be an adjudication. You can only get a dismissal without prejudice. That's inconsistent with the third step of the TCPA.
Your Honor, I think if I understand the court's question correctly, then under the third step, what the court would be determining is the entitlement to judgment as a matter of law, which is the language of the statute. So if the court gets to the third step here, which we don't think is necessary given the lack of evidence on the second step, that would be the finding, the entitlement to judgment as a matter of law.
Whether we get to the third step or not, it was anticipated and put in by the legislature, and the existence of the third step and the adjudication, should that not inform our interpretation of in reconsidering DeAngelis?
Your Honor, I think that the majority of courts of appeals that have considered this question read it the way that I hope that I've articulated, that the question at the third prong is just entitlement to judgment as a matter of law, and they don't find an enforcement argument as foreclosing the possibility of that dismissal action.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. In DeAngelis against Protective Parents Coalition, a panel of this court held that Rule 202 petitions fall within the definition of legal action in Section 27.0016 of the Texas Civil Practice and
Remedies Code. Mr. Mitchell, if you can speak up just a little.
Sure.
So we have an air conditioner back here, and it's louder back here than it is there.
I'm sorry about that.
It's okay.
DeAngelis, the panel of this court held that a Rule 202 proceeding falls within the definition of legal action in Section 27.0016 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. DeAngelis then went on to hold that Rule 202 petitions, therefore, could be subject to a motion to dismiss under the Texas Citizens Participation Act. But that conclusion does not follow from the premise. The TCPA allows only a party to move for dismissal of a legal action. And the would-be deponent in a Rule 202 proceeding is not a party to that Rule 202 petition. In a Rule 202 petition, there is only one party, and it is the petitioner who is asking the court for permission to depose another person. Deponents or would-be deponents do not become parties to a court proceeding by virtue of their being deposed. That is true in normal civil litigation, and it is equally true in the Rule 202 context. Neither Montoya Frazier nor the Buckle Bunnies Fund was a party to the Rule 202 proceeding in the district court. They were merely targets of Mr. Maxwell's request to take depositions prior to suit.
Can I ask you, Mr. Mitchell, I understand that this is Justice Pemberton's view of things. Are you aware of any case? I know that no court of appeals has embraced that or written further on that, but are you aware of any of those cases in which one of the parties briefed that issue and tried to sell that argument?
I'm not aware of one, and we've had no court accept the argument, as counsel for the appellants pointed out, but we also have had no court reject the argument. And I believe the reason, Justice Kerr, is that it just hasn't been presented to the courts. Once this court ruled in DeAngelis that Rule 202 petitions were subject to the TCPA, that seemed to settle the issue. And I don't think litigants believed the court would reconsider that stance by presenting this party argument, because DeAngelis seems to foreclose that type of ruling. Now, we don't believe it does, because, of course, DeAngelis never reached the question, and cases do not stand for precedent on issues they never discussed and did not raise. But interestingly enough, the Elliott majority opinion never even tried to refute Justice Pemberton's argument on this point. The majority does address Justice Pemberton's other arguments with respect to the definition of legal action, where the majority had a much stronger textual argument. But the majority had nothing to say at all about the meaning of the word party in the TCPA.
I may be digging deep here, and you may not know this, and I definitely don't. I haven't looked this far. But did the parties in that case actually brief this issue, or did Judge Pemberton just appear to come up with it?
I didn't go back and look at the briefs, yeah. Justice Walker. I did read Justice Pemberton's opinion, and it was careful and thoughtful, especially on that point. He also went on to address the issue of the meaning of legal action, where I think he didn't have nearly as strong of a textual argument as he did with respect to the word parties. But to me, the most powerful part of Justice Pemberton's opinion was the way he showed how the text and structure of the TCPA is incompatible with the reading that allows Rule 202 petitions to be subject to TCPA dismissals. He goes through those other provisions of the TCPA, 27.005C of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, 27.005D, 27.006A, all of these different provisions. If you look at the way they are phrased, it's very difficult to square that language in those provisions with the idea that Rule 202 petitions are subject to TCPA dismissals. If we look at the text of just one of these, if we take a look at 0.005C in the TCPA, this requires the party who brings the legal action to establish, quote, by clear and specific evidence, a prima facie case for each essential element of the claim in question. It's hard to see how that fits with a Rule 202 petition. We're not bringing a claim when we petition for permission to take a deposition under Rule 202. We don't really have elements of the claim. There are elements we have to prove to show our entitlement to take a deposition, but that's not a legal claim. We're not seeking relief against the party that we're seeking to depose. We just want to take their deposition. If you look at the other provision cited in Justice Pemberton's opinion, 27.005D, this allows the moving party to obtain a dismissal, quote, if it establishes an affirmative defense or other grounds on which the moving party is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. And this goes back to Justice Birdwell's question. Judgment as a matter of law. You don't have that in a Rule 202 proceeding. If the petitioner fails to meet his burden to show that he's entitled to a deposition, You don't enter judgment for the person he sought to depose. You don't enter any type of judgment as a matter of law. And this provision, 27.005D, seems to indicate that there needs to be judgment as a matter of law entered if the party that moves for the TCPA dismissal prevails on that motion.
Let me ask you something real quick on that point. Are you aware of any ruling on a Rule 202 that has been asserted as a res judicata, basis for res judicata or collateral estoppel in any other matter?
I'm not aware of one, Justice Birdwell. And the only time I could think that might ever arise is if someone tries to file a second Rule 202 petition against someone against whom a court has already denied permission to take a deposition. But I haven't researched the question. I'm not aware. I can't imagine a Rule 202, a failed Rule 202 petition would foreclose future litigation against the party, which is normally how res judicata plays. You can't bring any claims against that party that arises out of that same common nucleus of operative fact. Maybe there could be collateral estoppel effect if there was a finding on the two elements of the Rule 202 inquiry. That might be binding in a future proceeding, but it certainly wouldn't have the res judicata effect where you can't bring any type of lawsuit.
And again, the collateral estoppel would only be on the Rule 202 itself.
It's correct. Just on the Rule 202 issues.
You make the argument, it's kind of a subtle argument, I don't know if it's a direct, just overt argument, that even the way that the case is styled is indicative of the fact that there's only one party. Right. And when I read that, I was thinking to myself, are there any other in re cases that I can think of that seemed to be a little bit more like your typical case in controversy, your typical lawsuit on the merits? Do you know, I guess in the interest of candor with the tribunal, of any types of cases where we style cases in re something and it smells a little bit more like your typical lawsuit?
I think a petition for writ of mandamus would be the first thing that comes to mind in response to Your Honor's question.
Other
than mandamus, that's the easy answer.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes you can have ex parte captions in a habeas corpus petition. I haven't done much habeas work in the state courts. In federal court, habeas corpus petitions are brought against the warden, and he is a named respondent, so it's prisoner against warden. But my experience in the Texas state court system is a lot of petitions for habeas corpus are ex parte prisoner name without the warden necessarily being named as the defendant or the respondent. That's the other example where I can think habeas corpus is very much an adversarial presentation.
Sure. That
where
makes
you have
sense.
The lawyers for the state coming in and defending the legality of the conviction and sentence. So those are the best examples that come to mind. But I never hear, it's very hard to imagine Rule 202 proceedings in that particular context, or maybe more to the point, a TCPA dismissal being raised in a habeas corpus proceeding. That's, maybe it could be done in theory, but I've never seen or heard of a case where that happened, where someone tried to dismiss a habeas petition on TCPA grounds, and then that would force the court to address this party question that we're talking about today.
Counsel, so let's assume that we uphold DeAngelis, okay? Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court's made it real clear they're concerned about 202s being used in an abusive manner. In Wolf, they talk about shouldn't be used for forced interrogations, fishing expedition, or anything of that nature.
Right.
Okay. Ordinarily, when we have considered Rule 202, we're dealing with a concrete injury where somebody has been injured in some way. They have become aware of their injury, and they're seeking discovery concerning whether or not there is legal redress for that particular injury, a cause of action that may exist with regard to that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So here, there's a dispute about what the concrete injury is. The argument is that Mr. Maxwell has no concrete injury because he himself has not been injured.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What is your position as to what the concrete injury is?
We don't believe a concrete injury is necessary in this context because this is similar to a QI-TAM relator statute, where the legislature, just as they've done with civil Medicaid fraud, has empowered members of the citizenry to bring civil actions, not in the name of the state, but bring civil actions on their own behalf against lawbreakers or perceived lawbreakers. The appellants don't believe that's constitutional, and that's an issue that will eventually be litigated by the courts, whether it was constitutional for the state to do that. In the context of federal court, this would not be allowed. You have to have, under Article 3, every time, a concrete and particularized injury when you sue. Now, federal courts allow key TAM relator actions, and they've explained why that falls into an exception. But I would certainly acknowledge if we tried to bring a lawsuit like this in federal court under Article III, it would be thrown out. The rules in state court are somewhat different. Texas has expanded the doctrine of standing beyond what the U.S. Supreme Court has said in the context of Article III in several ways. Taxpayer standing is more broad in the state court system. Key TAM is allowed in both. And there are cases from the Supreme Court that say that the state legislature, if it creates a statutory cause of action, can authorize citizens to sue without a showing of a concrete or particularized injury. Now, the appellants don't agree with our readings of those cases, but I don't think that's properly before the court right now, because we haven't yet gotten to the point where we've had an appeal or a petition for mandamus being sought directly from the order allowing us to depose Ms. Montoya Frazier. So that would be an issue, I think, eventually for the court to address. I don't think it's properly presented here, because this was an appeal from the denial of a TCPA motion. So right now, the court only has jurisdiction to consider should the TCPA motion to dismiss have been granted. But it's a very important question. It will eventually be litigated, not only in this case, but others that are being brought under this somewhat novel statute. I'm happy to answer any other questions the court may have, either with respect to the application of the TCPA to Rule 202, or if the court wants to ask about the other issues that were briefed.
Are you conceding then that this is, are you relying exclusively on the party argument, or are you conceding that, and or are you conceding that the argument that this is not a legal action do you have an opinion of, our position on whether it's meritorious, the argument that this is not a legal proceeding?
We think it's very difficult to square that view with the definition in the statute of legal action. At the same time, there are respected jurists who have taken the view that legal action excludes Rule 202 proceedings. But when I look at the statute, it's just very hard to square that with the text. Now, the definition of legal action specifically includes petition, and this is a petition. It's called a Rule 202 petition.
There are also other uses of the word petition that would not be a legal action, like a generic petition, a petition for zoning or something like that that's filed at the city level. There's all kinds of uses of the word petition that wouldn't seem to fall under the TCPA.
That's true, but I think those petitions aren't requesting legal or equitable relief. That's the other part of the definition.
Well, so it depends on what you consider equitable relief, because the argument here is that the equitable relief is the taking of the deposition.
Right.
But is that truly relief in a legal sense? I mean, relief traditionally, in my mind, when they use the phrase legal, declaratory, equitable, they're talking about juxtapositioning legal and equitable, as we always have through law. Is it law or equity? And then they threw in declaratory because that's kind of a different type of relief. But it all ends in an adjudication of rights, that relief being used in that sense. And now we're using relief in this more generic, you got something you wanted.
Right.
You got a deposition, that's a relief. And I think, at least traditionally, relief meant more than just you got something that you wanted. It means you had your legal status determined.
We thought about this argument, Madam Chief Justice, and one of the difficulties that I had in trying to square that language with what Your Honor is talking about, the meaning of equitable relief, is normally, and the Supreme Court said this in Grupo Mexicano, we look to the history of equity in determining whether something is considered equitable relief. There's a long pedigree of English equitable courts that had certain types of remedies they would issue. And there was this idea of perpetuating testimony in anticipation of a trial the courts of equity would give at English common law. So as someone who has quite a bit of sympathy for originalism and textualism, it was hard for me to see that, or it was hard for me to make the argument that this was not a form of equitable relief, given that this was a remedy that English equitable courts gave throughout, you know, long before our country even existed. So I do think it's possible to interpret the word relief in the way Your Honor is suggesting. I don't want to say that that's a meritless argument or a frivolous one or a non-meritorious one, but it doesn't seem to accord with historical practice.
But that's one of Judge Pemberton's central arguments, that you're talking about equitable relief simply from the standpoint you're accorded a right to discovery, and we shouldn't read equitable relief that broadly.
Right. And certainly there's no judgment entered in a Rule 202 proceeding. So, you know, we could say relief means only the type of relief you get from a court at the end of a case that's incorporated into a judgment. That's normally what people think of when it comes to relief. But the statute says legal and equitable relief. It's now been expanded to include declaratory relief. It almost seems as though they're talking about everything a court can do because they've included all these different modifiers. So,
but the declaratory modifier makes sense because sometimes that's exactly how something is teed up through a deck action. Yeah. And the court declares rights. And when the court declares rights in a deck action, then they're adjudicating that. And to Justice Birdwell's point, then there's res judicata and collateral estoppel issues.
Right. And that's more, I think, the judgment of a matter of law phrase that appears in the TCPA, which we think really helps us, that section in 27.005D of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. Again, I think there are words here, relief, equitable. They can be interpreted in different ways, but when I try to interpret terms in a statute, I look for some type of anchor in history or tradition or historical practice to try to interpret what that means. When there's no definition in the statute itself, there's no provision in the TCPA that defines what they meant by relief. There's no provision in the statute that defines what they meant by equitable. So normally in those situations where it's left undefined by the legislature, history is the normal thing to fall back on. And it was just hard for me looking at the historical practice to deny that this was a form of equitable relief because it was the type of remedy the courts of equity traditionally would issue.
Well,
that's why we put more emphasis on the party argument.
So sort of adjacent to that point, I guess, is I've seen a couple of legal commentators post-2019 amendments say that the carve-out for a procedural action taken and the rest of that clause, I have to admit, is almost impossible to parse.
Yeah.
But there are commentators that have said it remains to be seen whether that addition makes it more tenable to say that the TCPA doesn't apply to 202s.
I was about to pull up this language that you said was impossible to parse to see if we talked about this a little bit at the very end of our brief.
Right, right.
And there is, I think, a kernel of an argument there that could help us because this is certainly a procedural action. And courts have said this is a procedural action. But then the statute goes on to say, I'm going to try to find the exact language here, but you know, it's a procedural action that, where is it?
Yeah, it's a procedural action taken in an action that does not amend or add a claim for legal, equitable, or declaratory relief is one way to read it.
It's taken in an action modifier. Does it have to be? It's initiating an action. It's not taken in a pre-existing action.
Right.
So that was somewhat of a stumbling block for us. Again, we still made the argument. I don't want to concede it or say that it's not something the court should consider. We did want to at least present this idea to the court as a possible way for resolving the case. I just don't think that's as strong of an argument for us as the party argument. To the extent there's a weakness in our party argument, it could be that party might be construed to mean any person. Sometimes people use the word party that way. Sometimes courts and statutes use the word party to talk about anybody and not just a formal party to a proceeding. But again, I think if we look at the context of the way party is used in Rule 202 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, it's talking about a party being the petitioner. And you never see anywhere in Rule 202 where the word party is used to refer in any way to the person being deposed. Also, Rule 202 of the Rules of Civil Procedure does not give the person being deposed the title of respondent. Sometimes you see that term thrown around. Certainly when we were litigating this in the district court, the appellants called themselves the respondents below in their court filings. And I was guilty of the same, perhaps, misnomer when I filed my certificates of service. I would say I served this on my opposing counsel, and I would list their names and addresses and say at the end, counsel for respondents. But what's interesting is Rule 202 does not call them that. That was a name that I used in the brief, I think out of habit. But maybe if I had been a purist, I should have gone back to the actual text of Rule 202 and realized these are not respondents. They're not parties. I should just call them counsel for the person we wish to depose, perhaps.
Receiving individuals?
Yeah, maybe. I'll find some other nomenclature to use if this case goes back on remand.
The proposed deponent.
I will not make that mistake again now that I have had the opportunity to brief this issue for the court. The one last point that I would make is In re Jordan, which counsel for the appellants mentioned at the outset, and this was mentioned on the slides that they submitted yesterday as part of their exhibit. I see my time's expired.
You can finish the thought.
I just finished the point. That dealt with a medical liability statute that banned a discovery from being taken until an expert report was served. There was a carve-out in the statute for non-party discovery under Rule 205. Not Rule 02, 205. And what the court held is that the person who was the target of the Rule 202 petition was going to be a party in the anticipated suit. Jordan did not hold that that person was a party to the Rule 202 proceeding. That's the key distinction. All Jordan says is this person had party status for this future lawsuit that had yet to be filed. We don't think that's applicable here. And we, again, encourage the court to read the opinion to see the full context of that discussion.
I'll do a pull bird well here. The last sentence of 27003A, a party under this section does not include a governmental entity, agency, or other official or employee acting in official capacity. Does that help or hurt your party argument? I don't think
that party may file a motion to dismiss. I don't think it hurts us because when I look at that sentence, I'm thinking of government entities that have been sued as defendants. And they certainly are parties to a case. I've never heard of a Rule 202 petition being filed against a government entity. Or I suppose it could be filed against a government employee. But in that particular context, he would not be a party. This sentence still can coexist with our argument.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, I already have a question for you over here. You cite the a couple of cases from the 1st and I think the one from the 14th, and forgive me for not pulling those up and reading them. I had 7 cases on submission yesterday, but you don't mention the rationale they leveraged and reaching that conclusion that the TCPA does not apply to Rule 202 petitions. What is the rationale? Is it this equitable argument, or is it something else?
Your Honor, as best of my recollection, those opinions rely on the legal action questions about, is this the kind of, you know, lawsuit or legal action that we typically see? The definition of petition is mentioned in one of them as well. Party is not mentioned at all. That is not brought up in any of the majority opinions from the courts of appeals. And I think those issues are ones, again, we have sort of this rare point of agreement between the parties that this does properly fall under legal action. So the reasoning in the Houston Courts of Appeals opinions, I think both the parties today would say, don't hit the nail the right way and don't perform the analysis the proper way. Dealing with the In re Jordan decision, because a couple points on rebuttal, but I think that one matters as we discuss the party issue, which seems to be this application clash point. In re Jordan is cited in the briefing, to be clear. The reason that it makes it into the oral exhibits but not into our supplemental briefing is because the party argument came up in the request for supplemental briefing on the other side. And so it's obviously not something that's been hashed out deeply in front of the court, and we appreciate the opportunity to do it now at the podium instead. The TMLA application, as counsel notes, there's this non-party depositions under 205, as determined by 205. 205 gives us the definition of non-party, which helpfully is a person who is not a party to the proceeding. So even though the court says, oh, they're a non-party under the definition of 205, that's not really the dispositive issue here. Instead, what the court was saying was faced with this similar kind of creative argument that the movement, the petitioner in that case, the Rule 202 petitioner, is saying, I want to get a non-party deposition. Nobody's a party yet. I filed a Rule 202 petition, so I want to take this depo even as a non-party. Essentially, the court said that proves too much. That's actually the language at 422, that it proves too much to say, while you are targeting, actually to use the language that my counsel on the other side used at the beginning of his argument, while you are targeting individuals or entities seeking this equitable relief from them, saying that they're not a party doesn't fit with the idea of what the legislature is trying to protect against merely by kind of trying to turn the way that Rule 202 lists a caption. So In re Jordan's holding that to list them as having adverse interest and then say they are non-parties is directly opposite what Maxwell's interpretation would have this court do. They are listed. To hold them as non-parties stands opposed to that more general Rule 202 holding in In re Jordan. The TCPA motion to dismiss is only asking for the relief that this pre-suit deposition not go forward. There doesn't have to be assessment of the merits. In fact, this inquiry should end with application, because the TCPA provides a critical guardrail against the kind of abuses that came up in argument as well, and then shifts the burden. Again, not an instant dismissal, but shifts the burden. If a petitioner is filing a suit or filing a legal action, in this case, based on response to the exercise of those protected rights, the legislature says that's important enough. We've got to make sure there's a prima facie case on the other side. In fact, I think our counsel on the other side's argument indicates some of the way that Texas courts have tried to do that already by saying, what about claim? There's not really a claim, so that would tend to also exclude the two. But courts easily make those two hold hands. There doesn't have to be a claim in the sense that we have this really strict, narrow definition, because the Rule 202 promulgates this sort of narrow, interesting, unique, Texas-specific vehicle for pre-suit discovery. You don't have to adjudicate the claim, but you do have to show that you need that pre-suit deposition and that there's a reason to have that now instead of actually filing suit, pursuing a claim, saying, I've got a burden of proof at the end of this road, and we're going to really tee up, have discovery rights on both sides, have counterclaims potentially on both sides, and really take the merits down the line. So the idea that just because claim might not contemplate Rule 202, courts soundly reject that. There's an easy way to combine the way that Rule 202 and the TCPA work together. Needing a clear and specific evidence of a prima facie case for the need for pre-suit discovery keeps those guardrails on Rule 202 and protects against the kind of forced interrogations with just a petition, with aggressive incendiary allegations, with no burden of proof at the end, just to use this as a vehicle to sit someone down and have the right to depose them, which is the relief offered by the court.
Judge Pemberton says you can address that in the context of the 202 proceeding.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't hear you.
I think Judge Pemberton said we can address those issues in the context of whether or not the 202 deposition should be permitted.
So certainly the burden and the need for pre-suit deposition is also a relevant inquiry in the abuse of discretion portion of the Rule 202 deposition itself. Additionally, though, the legislature protects against, and I see my time is out. May I briefly answer your question? Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. The legislature protects against the kinds of actions that at least trigger that protected exercise of protected constitutional rights. Because the legislature sees those as important enough to protect, this court should as well in reverse.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I want to thank all the attorneys for appearing here today and arguing. It was very helpful to the court. We do appreciate that. The case has been submitted, and we are now adjourned.